The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer and editor here in the Free Library's author events office, and I'm honored to be here tonight to introduce George L. Contreras. Specializing in intellectual property and science policy, George L. Contreras is a professor of law and ethics of human genetics at the University of Utah. His more than 100 scholarly articles have appeared in publications such as Science, Harvard Journal of Law and Technology, and Nature. And he has been featured on BBC Radio, NPR, and PRI, among other media outlets. A member of the advisory board of the American Antitrust Institute, Contreras has served on several other high-level governmental research and legal boards. He joins us tonight with the genome defense. Inside the epic legal battle to determine who owns your DNA, it follows the intense high-stakes courtroom fight undertaken by ACLU lawyers, activists, and scientists against biotech companies seeking to patent the very material that makes us who we are. Among the cast of real-life characters also includes judges, cancer survivors, doctors, ethicists, policymakers, and more. A review in Nature magazine states that this book is ably and affectingly detailed. This story stands as a guide to the forces that shape an increasingly important industry and to the vexed influence of patents. George will be joined in conversation tonight with Orly Lobel, author of You Don't Own Me, The Court Battles That Exposed Barbie's Dark Side. The award-winning author of several other books and numerous articles, she is the Warren Distinguished Chair Professor of Law at the University of San Diego and received her doctoral and law degrees from Harvard University. She is also a prolific speaker, commentator, and scholar who travels the world lecturing about policy and industries. Thank you both so much for being here, and the screen is all yours.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I think I'll start it off, George, because first of all, I want to congratulate you and thank you for writing this amazing book. It's already becoming a classic, and I really think it will be one of the classics of these character-driven nonfiction legal thrillers that will be among the ranks of A Civil Action, Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, and Aaron Brockovich, to name a few in I think that realm, that really capture our attention, our imagination, teach us very important things about our society, about ourselves, about science. And you do all of that in such an engaging and such an accessible way that both lay readers and I think the people that are most in the know about all of these issues or come from different angles on it, from the science, from the policy, from the litigation, everybody that you know will enjoy this book. And I can't stop recommending it to my colleagues, my friends, my students. So thank you for that. And I have a lot that I want to hear from you and a lot of questions, but I thought I'll just ask you first to just tell us about this case, how it started. You write in the preface that already in 2009, you were hooked on the case, you know, well before your book came out. You had heard about this case when you were involved in ethics and science and the law, and you've contributed, you know, in so many ways to the literature and thinking and policy. But you started following it, and it was such an important case already when it started about this question of who owns our genetic sequences, who owns, you know, this very intimate information that is within our body. Can we patent it? So maybe tell us a little bit about how this case came to be and how it came up all the way to the Supreme Court.
Absolutely, Orly. Well, thanks so much for that kind introduction. So for those who don't know, this is a case about patent law. And as you know, as a result, it's kind of surprising to read an ordinary book for the general reader about patent law, but this was a really important issue, I thought. That's why I wanted to bring it to a general audience. So in patent law, there's a rule that we've had since the 19th century that you can't patent a product of nature, right? Something that you just go out into the forest or the ocean and find. You can use that thing and figure out uses for it that could be patented. But the thing itself, whether it's a plant or a fish or an algae, it can't be patented itself. And you might think that human genes fall into that category, right? Because they exist within every one of our bodies. We each have 20,000 genes or so, and they do all sorts of important things within our cells. But because of a kind of interesting logical path that got taken through the patent office back starting in the late 80s and the early 1990s, the patent office started to allow patents on human genes. Why is that? Because the genes themselves inside of your cells, they can't be patented. But when a researcher finds a gene and for the first time extracts it from the human body so that it's isolated and purified in the lab, well, then that isolated, purified gene that's not in a cell and it's not attached to a much longer chromosome, that doesn't exist in nature. And so the understanding of the patent office and patent lawyers was that you could patent those isolated and purified genes. And so over the years, without much notice at all, an increasing number of human genes were being patented. So that by 2005, a couple of researchers at MIT started to count these and came to the conclusion that about 20% of all human genes already were covered by patents, and the number was growing every year. People knew this, people who were experts and patent lawyers and, you know, deep within the biotech industry, but not many other people knew about this. And the interesting thing is that most of the people who knew about it, whether they were patent lawyers or people in biotech companies or pharmaceutical companies or universities who were getting these patents, everyone was happy with the patents, right? The people who were getting them, they were all pretty happy with the situation. And so no one was challenging this fact that you could get a patent on a human gene until this case came along. And it came along, and I don't know how much you want me to talk about the book itself, but it came along in a very interesting way, which was through the American Civil Liberties Union, right? Which is, of course, a famous civil rights organization, has been around for a century, and has litigated many important civil rights cases, but never litigated a patent case, didn't have any patent lawyers on staff, and really didn't even have policies around patents. They just weren't following these issues at all until in 2003, they hired someone, a young master's degree recipient from Berkeley, in an environmental policy program named Tanya Simoncelli. And the ACLU, because after 9/11, they received a large amount of funding from their work that they had done in combating civil rights abuses in the wake of 9/11. They doubled the size of their staff. And one of the people that they were able to hire was a science advisor. And Tanya Simoncelli was the first science advisor at the ACLU, who was there to talk to them about all sorts of civil rights issues that might arise from scientific technologies, right? Like DNA fingerprinting and functional magnetic resonance imaging of the brain. All of these issues could have civil rights implications. And one day, as she was tossing around some ideas for science issues that might have some legal impact, she was talking to a senior litigator at the ACLU named Chris Hansen, who had been there 30 years, a very distinguished career. He had argued cases from the, you know, the continuation of Brown versus Board of Education, the big school desegregation case, to online pornography, the Reno versus ACLU case. He had a distinguished career, but was talking with Tanya about these scientific issues. And she mentioned, well, you know, and then there's also gene patents. And surprisingly, he didn't even believe that that was a thing, right? And she mentioned this. He said, no, that can't be right. People can't patent genes. You must be thinking about, you know, patenting a process or a method for extracting DNA. And she said, no, Chris, I'm telling you, this has been going on for a long time. Companies have patents on genes. And he would not believe her. He thought she must have made a mistake. She wasn't a lawyer, mind you. So his assumption was that she was misunderstanding some legal principle. But she said, no, I'm going to show you. And she goes, she finds some articles from the literature, sends them to him by email. And then literally 20 minutes later, he storms back into her office and says, oh my God, you're right. This is happening. Who can we sue? Right. And so that kicks off this very long road that the ACLU takes to bring this case.
And I'll just interject here that, you know, you're already describing it in such a vivid way of the back and forth. But I love that scene in the book where there is this real eagerness by Tanya, who is new to the ACLU, but also young and just a very driven scientist, science policy expert who wants to make a difference. And she comes to Chris Hansen's office, and it's not even the first kind of issue that she's kind of brainstorming with him. How are they going to get the ACLU involved in these questions of science? So she says, fMRI, you know, what about the fact that, you know, brain imaging can become a lie detector and we're going to convict people for, you know, murder because something is green or red on the imaging? And he says, well, you know, maybe there's already policy on that side because it's like a lie detector. And then she says, oh, I have another idea. What about genetic discrimination? And he says, well, we have these like bills right now before Congress, and we have, we've been thinking about that. So maybe we don't need it quite yet, like as a litigation thing. We want to think about, you know, do you have anything else? And she's like, yes, I have the patenting. And as you say, he doesn't believe her. He is skeptical. And but then they both kind of throw themselves into this case. And the other, so you know, the these characters really come to life. You know, you really describe them in such a beautiful way about, you know, what is driving them. You know, how they have, you know, they're just full characters, full people. With you know, Tanya plays her cello, and you know, they all are so committed to what they're doing. But so before we talk about, you know, how it, you know, starts with the actual litigation, what happens is that they can have, you know, this intuition that something is wrong with us, you know, seeing all these patents being granted for our genetic makeup, but they need plaintiffs. And so there is this whole next process that the story you tell about, you know, how do you get the best plaintiffs? How do you get very appealing plaintiffs? And I love the way that it became focused also as kind of a women's feminist issue, because it really, the case itself became about the BRCA or the BRCA mutations for testing for breast cancer. It, you know, you have, actually the book is really cool with having also images. So I think the first image, you have pictures of the characters, but you also have an image of the women standing before the Supreme Court and saying, don't patent our genes. So tell us a little bit about that, the process of first, you know, finding a way to get standing before the court.
Right. So standing to sue is one of these technical civil procedure issues, right? That sounds really boring, but really became a super important issue in this case. And so back in the 90s, the ACLU could bring cases in its own name, civil rights cases. So Reno versus ACLU, where they challenged the Communications Decency Act that outlawed online porn, the ACLU brought in its name. But over the years, like the Supreme Court continued to ratchet up the requirements to bring a lawsuit in this country. And really, they ratcheted up the need to be injured in some specific way by whatever you were challenging. And so the ACLU couldn't stand in for the American people anymore. It needed to find in its cases some organizations or people who were actually injured by whatever it was they were challenging. And so they became very good at doing this, at assembling coalitions of plaintiffs who could be representative of those who were injured by the law that they were challenging. And so in this case, they spent a huge amount of time. They spent 4 years preparing this case right before it was actually brought. From 2005 to 2009, they were laying the groundwork and doing all of this background stuff, which is pretty amazing in itself. But they found a number of types of plaintiffs, right? One were associations. So the lead plaintiff is the Association for Molecular Pathology. And when you read the case, it's called Association for Molecular Pathology versus Myriad Genetics. And they're the trade association for basically genetic diagnostics practitioners, testing labs, and so forth. And that's an obvious group. But other groups, the American College of Medical Genetics and groups of scientists and researchers who were affected by the patents, because once a company gets a patent on a gene, they own every possible use of that gene, right? And so any testing that's done on the gene is controlled by that company. And so other diagnostic laboratories, genetic researchers, they all were affected in some way by this patent. So you've got associations, you've got individual researchers, geneticists and doctors, physicians who couldn't advise patients because they couldn't run these tests themselves. You've got activists, you've got Breast Cancer Action, which is a breast cancer support group turned activist organization. And you've got the Boston Women's Health Collective, the people who published the book, Our Bodies Ourselves. So there's sort of public interest organizations like that. And then you've also got individual plaintiffs, six individual women who were carried these BRCA mutations, but were unable to afford the test. And again, because this one company had a patent on the genes, the BRCA genes, it literally could dominate the market and shut out all of the providers. So there is no competition for the price of this testing, and it could charge whatever it wanted. And, you know, a cholesterol test or a blood sugar test that you get when you go to the doctor, you're like $50, $100. But this test was over $3,000 and it wasn't covered by most insurance policies. And so that left a lot of women unable to afford it, even though they might've had a family history of cancer. And they suspected that they might carry this mutation. And if they did carry it, if you found out that you carried this mutation, there are some pretty drastic preventative measures that you could take, including getting a prophylactic surgery, either a removal of the breast tissue or removal of the ovaries and fallopian tubes, which obviously reduce your risk of cancer substantially. But A, are expensive. They're not risk-free surgeries. And you don't want to do it if you don't have a pretty good certainty that you actually should get these. So these six women were representative of the class of people who were unable to get tested.
Yeah. So famously, Angelina Jolie was one of the people that early on found that out, that she is a carrier of the BRCA gene, and she had publicly, described deciding to take those preventative measures. And I think that she also wrote an op-ed against the patenting of these genes. So it became very high profile in that way that, you know, celebrities like her that can afford taking the test, whatever it costs, we're doing it, but others can't. And like these six plaintiffs. And actually the moment that I said, this is just like Erin Brockovich when I was reading the book was this moment, I think that somebody from Myriad, the company that owned the patents that was being sued, I think they call up one of the plaintiffs and try to convince her to drop the case because they say, now you've actually got an access to the case. And she, I think, like classic, you know, hangs up on them, says, you know, you assholes, it took us, you know, took me, I don't know, 2 years to get the test. And meanwhile, you know, they're, I think she's a cancer survivor. Several of them are cancer survivors who couldn't afford the test. And it really, I think what it brings out, and this is something that I want to talk to you about more generally, it shows how the stakes are so high with patents and intellectual property that it's, in this case, it's literally about life and death, but it is about our lives, and it's about the winners and losers, the haves and haves not, and it's about you know, distributive justice. So your book and this context, it focuses more on the United States and the winners and losers within, you know, our country. But as you have a note in the book about how these are battles that were going on in other countries, and it's global. And of course also, and I won't ask you about this quite yet, but of course it right now with COVID-19, which is something that you've been very much a leader on, thinking kind of distributive justice on who gets vaccinated, we see how global it is about, you know, who has access to medicine and to all these innovative goods that we care about, technology and science and art. Again, before I ask you about kind of bigger policy questions, I want to ask you about the wins and losses in the courts. And, you know, this was a case with twists and turns. And even the win in the Supreme Court by the ACLU and all these activists, it's a partial win. And I want to ask you about that. You know, what happened, and, you know, how do you read the law that we have now, the decision that we have now, which is kind of, I'll state it, but you'll state it better, that decides that the DNA sequences are not patentable because they are not man-made, they exist in nature. But then there is this kind of other series of patents that Myriad and others were getting, which is complementary DNA, which is kind of just a partial sequencing that don't exactly exist in nature, but it's still, I think, and I think you would agree, it's still like part of our human code. And in the Supreme Court, they kind of, they make that distinction, and I want to ask you about it.
Yeah, absolutely. There were a lot of twists and turns, and, you know, of all the judicial decisions in this case, because there are five of them, right? Five of substance. There's a lower court, the trial court, three different opinions come out of the intermediate appellate court. I guess they do it twice, so there are six of them, and then the Supreme Court. The one that I like the best is Judge Sweet's opinion at the district court. I think he really got it the most right. And what did he say? Well, number one, and this is a fascinating piece of the story. He had the assistance of a law clerk. You know, all federal district judges have a couple of law clerks. And his law clerk just happened to have a PhD in molecular virology. And I think really helped. I mean, I interviewed them both, and they were both, you know, they respected the confidentiality of the chamber, but we all know that this clerk helped quite a bit write the opinion, because I think they really got it right. That the purpose of the function of DNA these days is not, it's an information carrier. It is a molecule, it has a chemical structure, just like a carbohydrate or a sugar or a polymer. But the chemical structure, other than the fact that it carries this information, isn't that important. And so Judge Sweet's opinion said, look, the patent is on the DNA sequence, whether it's in the body or outside of the body, same sequence. And so that's a product of nature, shouldn't be patented. The intermediate court, the Federal Circuit, reversed him, of course, I mean, focusing very much on the chemical structure of DNA that, oh, well, you know, the gene inside the body, it's part of this long chromosome. And one of the funniest interactions I had with Chris Hansen was his story to me about how at the oral argument of the Federal Circuit, Judge Lurie, who's the chief judge on the panel, asks him, well, you know, Mr. Hansen, what about when you take the gene out of the body, you break covalent bonds? You know, what about that? And Chris didn't even know what covalent bonds were. Like, that had never come up. That's, for a geneticist, that's totally irrelevant. Nevertheless, this, you know, the chemical structure was super important to the Federal Circuit. And the Supreme Court splits the baby, right? Following the lead of the Solicitor General and the Department of Justice, at the Supreme Court, Justice Thomas, who writes the opinion for a unanimous court, which in itself is kind of rare for anyone who follows the Supreme Court, right? The unanimous court says, okay, the sequence of DNA that's in the body, in the cell, we'll call that genomic DNA. It's a product of nature. You can't patent it. But DNA, it's, well, at least we think its main function is coding proteins. In the BRCA1 gene, to say it's something like 80,000 bases long, those are the A's, T's, G's, and C's, right, that make up the sequence, 80,000 bases long, only 6,000 of those bases actually do the work of coding proteins. There are some applications for which you would create a construct of just those 6,000 coding bases and leave out the other 74,000. They're just kind of junk, or they're probably not. We don't know exactly what they do today, but we'll only, you know, take out the 6,000 coding ones. Those, that region of 6,000 coding bases, they're scattered across the entire range of the 80,000 bases in the gene. And so when you just yank out the 6,000 and string them together, that construct doesn't exist in nature. So we're going to say that cDNA construct, which you mentioned, that would be patentable. So the full 80,000 base sequence in the gene is not patentable, but if you take it out and just use the coding regions and create that in the lab, it would be. Now, the ironic thing is it's kind of a Pyrrhic victory for the company Myriad, because, you know, from a diagnostic standpoint, you don't make those cDNA constructs. You know, you can get patents on stuff that you don't do. Right, when you're writing one of these patent applications, you claim everything that you can think of that might be possible. And so, of course, your patent lawyers, they hired good patent lawyers, are going to get patents on the cDNA constructs as well as the sequence in the gene. But for a diagnostics company, you know, the mutations in the BRCA gene that throw off its function, right? The BRCA genes are tumor suppressors. When there is a flaw in the gene, they don't correctly code their proteins that suppress tumors. But those flaws can occur both in the coding regions and the non-coding regions. And so from a diagnostic standpoint, you care about all of the base, all 80,000, not just the six. So it didn't help Myriad that much. If, on the other hand, you're making an antibody or something, then you might use that. But another irony of this is that for the BRCA genes, Myriad early on in its life did license therapeutic uses of the BRCA genes to Eli Lilly and company. And of course, everybody thought the huge money, like there was big money in diagnostic testing. Myriad made, you know, probably $1 billion in that business. But the really big money is in therapeutics and drugs, like a cancer treatment. And so they early on licensed all therapeutic uses of the gene to Lilly, who paid them millions of dollars for it and took some stock in the company. And that never panned out. We did not get cancer therapy out of the BRCA genes for one reason. We still might someday, but we didn't.
So that's a good place to ask you about, why do we have patents? Do we need them for therapeutic innovation, for diagnostic innovation? The other irony, I don't know if it's an irony, but it's just kind of a support for the position that we shouldn't patent these sequences is that there has been a lot of innovation since the Myriad decision came out. Here in San Diego, we're in the biotech haven. I think a lot of the cancer research is done at the Salk Institute and other places. And where you are at Utah actually is where Myriad and University of Utah collaborate and continue, to do really well. My understanding is that Myriad is still very profitable, continues to do really well. And so what does this victory, the decision that was handed down by the Supreme Court, what does it tell us about how do we draw the lines on patent policy, on intellectual property? How do we get the incentives right for innovation?
Yeah, and that's sort of the, billion, trillion-dollar question, right? Where you draw that line is difficult. This case, if nothing else, it does make you think about these questions really deeply. So the ground story for patents and the story that we've had in the Constitution since, and the Patent Act since 1790, right, is that patents are there to incentivize innovation, the progress of arts and useful arts and sciences. It's a very utilitarian purpose, and we want to incentivize these things. And it is true that drug discovery and drug development is expensive. And without some exclusivity, for some period of time, companies who develop and discover drugs probably could not afford the estimates from like $700 million to $2 billion that it costs, to bring a new drug from discovery of a molecule to, being on the shelves at Walgreens. And so patents are probably needed to some degree. Are patents needed on these products of nature, right? The genes themselves? I would say no. I agreed with the ACLU in this case. And why is that? Well, number one, in the case of the BRCA genes, there were a dozen academic groups racing to find these genes for a number of years. And Myriad with the University of Utah won that race, but not by much, right? Other groups were pretty close on their heels. You're right, this is just mostly a story of the US, but there's a UK aspect of this story too. And in the UK, with respect to the BRCA2 gene, the one that's more closely related to ovarian cancer, the Myriad team beat a group at Imperial College by literally one day. Myriad filed its US patent application the day before that group's paper came out in Nature. You didn't need patents to spur that innovation. For more rare diseases, you might not have had these international races going on, so it's more arguable. But whatever the case is, you also don't need a patent on the gene as a composition of matter in order to create a drug and patent a drug. So the Eli Lillys of the world who are creating these drugs, there are many things that you can patent. As we know from the COVID-19 story, right? So DNA and RNA sequences are not patentable anymore. And we saw that in late 2019, when researchers first sequenced the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes COVID-19, They did not patent that sequence. They released it to the GenBank public database, and scientists around the world immediately started studying it. That is actually different than what happened with H1N1 and SARS, some of these earlier viral outbreaks. The viral DNA sequence itself was patented, which, you know, Matthew Rimmer and others have written about, caused problems and delays in the research. So that didn't happen here. Yet Moderna and Pfizer, BioNTech, these companies that created vaccines, they certainly got patents. They didn't need the patents on the organism itself. And, you know, the way, of course, we all come with our priors and our biases. One of the very first projects I ever worked on in the area of genomics was back in the late 90s. And my technical background is in electrical engineering, right? I'm not a biologist by training. But back in the late 90s, when the Human Genome Project was going on, I worked at a law firm. The law firm portrayed in the book, A Civil Action, by the way. And we represented a consortium of pharmaceutical companies. And their goal was to put out into the public domain a bunch of DNA sequence information alongside the Human Genome Project. And why is that? It wasn't because these pharmaceutical companies were, you know, acting in a particularly altruistic way, but because they realized that if they didn't put this in the public domain, a biotech company would come along and patent all of that stuff, and then it would just charge for it. Whereas the pharmaceutical companies knew that they could get patents on more downstream products and drugs, but the basic discoveries should be available for free to all of them. And so I think there are plenty of financial incentives and plenty of patents available for the pharmaceutical industry without patenting these basic products of nature.
Yeah, it absolutely. I think that's what you show. And toward the end of the book, you talk more about those broader implications. And more recently, I know that you've been involved in the Open COVID Pledge, looking also at pathogens that we do have and that maybe are in normal times more justifiable definitely more justifiable than genetic sequencing, but even on those things that need that incentives, that like innovating a medical device or a delivery system, even then we might think that during a pandemic we need to suspend the rights to rapidly together get the pandemic under control. So it's something that I know you've done a lot of it on, if you want, you can talk about that, but I actually want to ask you about another aspect of what we own and who controls information. The book is called The Genome Defense, but I kept thinking, I wonder if George's next book could be called The Data Defense, and it seems like it would be a good path for the ACLU to take, where the things that Myriad and many, many other not only medical and pharma companies, but if you think about Apple, like on wearables and Google and everybody else that's huge players in the tech and data industry, the thing that they own that is most valuable these days is really not something that they patent, but they just keep as proprietary. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about that on the Myriad side. This actually goes to the Henrietta Lacks kind of questions of just getting information. There's that asymmetry between, you know, how data is collected and, you know, provided, and just the carriers of data, which is us, and then the concentration of ownership over data. And I'm wondering if that's kind of a next natural step of thinking about distributive justice and how do we democratize that knowledge to increase innovation and access.
Yeah. It's a really good point. And you'll be happy to know that people at the ACLU are actually thinking about this. In particular, I'll just give a shout out to Sandra Park, who was one of the lawyers at the ACLU from the Women's Rights Project, who joined in bringing this case and by the end became kind of its chief architect, as Chris Hansen had retired by the end of the case. But she has continued to look at these issues. And so data, you're so right, it's hugely important. You know, Myriad, in the mid-2000s, Myriad realized its patents were going to expire. You know, patents in the US last for 20 years from the date of filing. Myriad's patents issued before that rule came into effect, so they would last, for the most part, 17 years from the date of issuance. Even so, they were going to expire. And so to prepare for that, they started to keep their data private. And in fact, they did this in a very determined way. There had been a lot of data sharing among scientists. I remember Myriad came out of the University of Utah. Many of its researchers were university academic scientists who generally are used to sharing data and pooling data. There's a big database at NIH of breast cancer information, right? Genetic information about breast cancer, in particular, the mutations that are linked to it. The BRCA genes are very, they're big and they're kind of loose and chaotic genes, if that makes any sense. There are a lot of mutations that occur in those genes. They're kind of unstable. And some of those mutations make no difference. You know, say out of the 80,000 bases, if base number 79999 is switched, it probably doesn't make any difference. But, you know, some do make a big difference. And there are thousands of those variants, right? Back in the 90s, there were these three big variants that a lot of families had that everybody knew were linked to cancer, but there are others that might be more rare. And so who knows if you have these different variations? Well, Myriad does, right? They get a blood sample from a patient and they give them back their results, but they don't give it back with a lot of specificity, right? They tell them you've got one of these mutations that's going to give you an X percent greater risk and so forth. But they really keep your full sequence in-house. And they also know whether you had cancer or not, right? I mean, they're keeping this information private. They're not just publicizing your name and whatnot, but internally they know. And so they can keep improving their test. Each patient who they sequence, they get better and better data about which variants are harmful and which variants are not harmful. And at one point they would put that into patent applications. And so at least the world would know from that patent application what these variants are. But they decided we're going to stop that because these patents have limited life. The data that we can keep secret will last forever, right? The secrecy will last forever. We never have to give that away. When we were giving it away in patent applications, A, our US patents have limited life. B, in other countries like Canada, for example, people were just ignoring their patents. And, you know, they weren't able to enforce their patents in a lot of countries. So why give the information away for free? So it turned out that even after Myriad lost its patents, it still had the biggest database in the world of BRCA variants and, you know, what they mean in terms of health outcomes. Now, there have been public efforts to try to build up a public database. And the public database today it's estimated to be bigger than Myriad's database. But, you know, it would be better if both of those databases were put together. You would learn a lot more and it would just be much better. You probably would save lives as a result of this.
Right. Great. So I have more questions, but we already have four questions on the queue and I want to get audience questions. You know, you can send more questions as we go. I'm monitoring the queue. So I'll just read the first one. LK asks, what will the proliferation of more and more sophisticated CRISPR technology and human gene editing in general mean to this issue? Will this give biotech companies a dangerous level of control over our bodies and health?
Right. Well, so CRISPR gene editing, right, is a technology that is patented, but which allows researchers someday in the future, right, not yet, but soon probably, to edit DNA sequences as they're in our body, right, germline DNA sequences, as well as, you know, for disease therapy and so forth. So with the decision in the Myriad case, those edited sequences that occur in nature shouldn't be patentable, right? So you could say, okay, look, here's a person who, you know, lived to be 107 years old and she smoked a cigar every day and somehow she never got cancer. There's probably something pretty useful in her DNA that we might want to replicate. And suppose we do find like a super tumor suppressor in that person's DNA, and we decide we should give everybody that tumor suppressor mutation. Well, we could do that, or in theory, we can't do it yet. Someday, soon, we'll be able to do that. Could you patent that modification? And the answer should be no. If this case stands, and by the way, there are efforts in Congress to overturn all of these Supreme Court cases relating to patent eligibility, which is a different story. But today, that naturally occurring mutation that we just port to other people shouldn't be patentable, although the basic technology around CRISPR is patentable. And I've written about that too and have some complaints about how that's being licensed. But on the other hand, if researchers just say, you know, we have learned all about tumor suppressors and how, you know, the body reacts to tumors, and we think that a good, you know, edit would be this one, and it isn't something they just found in nature, that unique edit probably would be patentable. So there is still significant territory that is going to be subject to patents. And, you know, whether that's a good thing or not, you get back to the incentives question, but at least there is this safe harbor that if it's something that nature created, it's outside of that realm at the moment.
Great. So that actually relates to the next two questions, so I'll ask them together. Ray asks, how do we help lawmakers, particularly at the federal level, understand this issue, let alone legislate about it, given that many members of Congress seem to have a poor grasp on technology in general? And that's also true on, you know, kind of the court side and understanding science. And then Penny asks, I assume the government doesn't want to impede innovation or research, but I wonder why the Justice Department or NIH lawyers weren't deployed to bring this lawsuit.
Well, so first on the non-expertise question, I'll mention this was a unanimous Supreme Court decision, but Justice Scalia did get in a concurring opinion, three sentences long, basically where he raises that question. He says, you know, I don't know anything about molecular biology. And by the way, neither do the rest of you justices. So what are we even doing here? I think he sort of questions this case, probably voted against granting cert. But no, you're right. We have generalist judges and we have generalist legislators. And, you know, that's the way it has to be. Even if a congressperson is an expert in molecular biology, you know, they're not an expert in artificial intelligence or wireless telecommunications, you know, all the different technology issues that come before Congress. So that's just the way the system, that's the only way the system can work. So how do they deal with that? Well, lobbyists, I mean, primarily this is lobbyists, something that I learned in writing this book, that congressional staffers will sometimes have some expertise and they will look to, you know, they will look to experts to try to help them and their Congress people understand what's going on. Most of those experts are lobbyists paid by different industries, but it's fascinating. You know, in the book, I do talk about that legislative angle. And, you know, back in 2007 timeframe, you know, the ACLU people are there. They're thinking maybe we can get some help, some legislation get through on this. And they see how the sausage is made. That does not work out. But there is a staffer who's very interested in all of this, the staffer for Senator Obama, who eventually does play a role in this story. You know, there are lots of ways to provide input, though, from the public to Congress. There are groups like the ACLU and Breast Cancer Action, and I do have to give a shout out to a group called FORCE, Facing Our Risk of Cancer Empowered, which was very helpful in the case, and which is the support group for people who carry the BRCA mutations, many of whom do not have cancer at the moment, but are considering these drastic surgeries and treatment regimens to prevent that from happening. And groups like that have become increasingly sophisticated on issues like this and are having their voices heard and are actually providing input. Just a few months ago, at the request of a couple of US senators, the Patent Office issued a broad request for public input about how the biotechnology industry is being affected by these Supreme Court decisions. And of course, a lot of industry associations and companies responded to that. 140 different groups responded to this call. But in among those were also the ACLU and patient advocacy groups who really, again, they hadn't been super engaged on these issues until the last 10, 15 years. And so those are good ways to get input.
Great. The fourth question on the queue, and you can still type up a question if you want, but is by Danielle Amir Lobel, who I recognize as my daughter, who is a sophomore at Stanford and studying neuroscience. And she asks, should courts be able to use neuroimaging methods to read minds of witnesses? And so that, you know, you can answer that, but also just kind of new frontiers of science that we might be seeing on, you know, on the docket, if you have some ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are just an unlimited number of scientific issues that impact civil rights and human rights. And that brain imaging question, that really was one of the things that Tanya Simoncelli was thinking about in the book and in real life, right? She has gone on, she's now with the Chan Zuckerberg Institute or Foundation, leading all sorts of interesting work, some of which, you know, has related to the brain. You know, fMRI imaging, our evidentiary tests are, you know, whether something is reliable enough. I don't think we are even close to being able to tell if somebody is lying based on brain imaging. But, you know, decades and probably it's now a century ago, right, the polygraph lie detector tests were invalidated for evidentiary purposes in court, yet they're still used all the time by companies, by police departments, investigators, and I don't know why that is. There's still some faith in these, even though, again, from a judicial perspective, they've been somewhat debunked. So,
I'll just say that this is an area of my expertise in employment law. So the polygraph test actually was banned, ironically, by Congress for the private sector use, but they're still lawful in the public sector use. So the
purpose can I've definitely them, yeah. seen TV shows where the FBI is using those, right?
So yeah, no, they are using it, but it was just decided that even though they're inaccurate, they're useful, you know, they're better than chance. And also they create psychological terror. So they kept them for public agency use. Again, ironically. we have another question by Rich Paul, who is actually my colleague at University of San Diego and an expert on many things, including law and technology. He says, there seems to be an intersection between CRISPR technology, which you said is patented, and the specific patch replacements to DNA that it enables. If by means of a CRISPR cut a more efficacious gene sequence is discovered, do you think that specific sequence should be patentable if it is introduced into the human body? It would have been repaired by CRISPR, but is a natural sequence. How should we think about it?
Yeah, this case is coming. it's not here yet. And I don't think we have a perfect answer. I mean, if you go back, in 1980, the Supreme Court heard the famous Diamond versus Chakrabarty case, right? This was about an engineer at General Electric who modified a bacterium, naturally occurring bacterium, by inserting a plasmid into its DNA that made it more attracted to poly or petrocarbons, right? So that it would break down oil spills. In a divided 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court ruled that, yeah, you could patent that, right? The bacterium was a product of human ingenuity, or the modification was, and so you could patent it. To some degree, that sounds sort of like what's happening potentially with CRISPR. But then contrast that with the Myriad case. And what's less known is that after the Supreme Court's decision in Myriad in 2013, June of 2013, in October of 2013, Myriad took that little cDNA piece of the opinion and decided we're going to take this and run with it, and brought lawsuits against all of the new competitors who were doing BRCA testing. It brought the lawsuits not on the basis of its DNA claims, which had been invalidated, but claims that covered short probes and probes and primers that are used in the diagnostic process. And these probes and primers, they're short and they're made in the lab. They're synthetic. Nevertheless, even here, right here at the District of Utah, and then at the Federal Circuit, those patents were invalidated too. Why? Because the DNA sequence that they used, even though it was synthesized entirely in the lab, the sequence occurred in the naturally occurring genes. And so those were invalid also. And the fact that the Federal Circuit, which looks pretty kindly at patents, invalidated those, shows, I think, that we may see a change, right? At least as long as these cases remain on the books and they're not overridden by Congress, I think that the edit, right, the CRISPR edit itself is at risk of not being patentable. But we'll see, right? We'll see. That case hasn't come up yet. And I am assuming that it will be hotly fought.
Yeah, we will definitely follow it. So our time is almost up, but I want to conclude with asking you, and again, thanking you and saying how much I think this book is a triumph and a joy to read. I want to ask you maybe to say a few last words about the process of writing this book. Yeah, it's so well researched, so well written and organized. You've interviewed about 100 people and it took you several years to write it. So, as a nonfiction writer myself, and I'm sure the audience just wants to hear about, how you went about it, and maybe thoughts about the next book.
I have to say that this book is different than, any of the other books. And I have written other books, but, Utah Real Property Law is not getting the same type of attention as this. And because it is written for a general audience. And I think part of that is, as you know, because your book on the Barbie Bratz Mattel case was one of my models for, figuring out how to write a narrative nonfiction book about a legal topic. And there's a lot, that we do in legal academic writing. We read cases, we look at dockets, we look at documentary evidence, but we don't do those sort of personal interviews that really get you inside of the story. And that's something I kind of had to figure out how to do on my own. And I'm not sure I was 100% successful, but I did stumble along, and I spent a lot of time with many of these people, the people who were the principal characters, Hansen and Simoncelli and Sandra Park and Dan Ravitcher. I met them. Most of this was in person. I flew all around the country interviewing these people. And that was really a wonderful experience, you know, something that I had never done before. But I felt like I got to know them and to understand their stories and where they were coming from. And you know, I have to say I owe these people an enormous debt of gratitude. I really consider myself just to be the messenger in this story. It is their story.
You and, say that this is their story.
It totally is. And yeah. You know, it's a very serious story. I'm sorry to say a number of the people who I met and interviewed are no longer living. And so I feel this, you know, that they've entrusted me with their story now, even after they're gone. And so I've really tried to respect that, you know, as much as possible. It really is a human story at the end.
Well, I can say that you were 100% successful in telling the story and engaging the reader. Again, everybody should read it before the movie should, you know, I think it should be also a movie. I hope somebody's looking into buying the rights to this book, but The Human Genome is just a book that, again, will become a classic, and I highly, highly recommend it. And it's getting also all these great reviews. The New York Times, I think, already marked it as one of the top nonfiction of the year to watch. So congratulations. Thank you.
No, thank you. No, I really do thank you for everything, Orly. And this has been a wonderful conversation. I enjoyed it.
Yes, thanks.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.